Your Honor, I'd just like to say, and what's this country coming to?
Raymer, shut the fuck up.
This isn't playtime. This is serious business.
Well, the play must go on, I believe.
I'm always home. I'm on tour.
I've been thinking a lot about dying lately.
I'm trying to do good. That's that.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of That's That, a Philip Seymour Hoffman retrospective podcast. My name is Timothy Mark Davis, and I'm your host. Today, we are talking about Nobody's Fool, the 1994 comedy, drama, starring Oscar winner Paul Newman, written and directed by Robert Benton of Kramer vs. Kramer fame. I hope you took the time to watch the film on Amazon Prime, because they don't make movies like this anymore, folks. Not that it was particularly great. Putting my cards on the table very early there. We'll see what Rick has to say, but I just mean this genre of film is dead. Speaking of Rick, my guest today is filmmaker, film professor, and friend, Rick Negron. Rick, how are you today?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me.
Ah, it's a pleasure. So, as I said, today we're talking about Nobody's Fool, which features a young Philip Seymour Hoffman in the three-scene role of Officer Raymer, a troubled and obnoxious police officer in the small fictional town of North Bath, New York, where the film is set. Here is the logline from IMDb. A stubborn man past his prime reflects on his life of strict independence and seeks more from himself. Here's the logline from Amazon Prime, which Amazon owns IMDb, so I don't know why these are always different. Here we go. Amazon Prime tells the story of a loner who walked out on his family years ago and now lives in a small town in New York. One day, his estranged son shows up with his grandson, sparking a reconciliation and a renewed stance of life for Donald. Who is Donald, first of all?
Sally?
Yes. That is. It's just so weird that that logline plants the name of the protagonist at the very end.
Yeah, and he's never called Donald in the film. I don't think, is he?
Oh, maybe the older, like, the Jessica Tandy character might refer to him as Donald.
Okay,
but yeah, everyone calls him Sully. Rick, you've seen the film. What do you think of these loglines?
Well, I guess the second one is more accurate. You had sent me the trailer, which,
oh my gosh,
yeah, it was basically like, you know, hey guys, come buy a ticket to see Paul Newman, and there was no story in it.
For nearly 40 years, he has delighted audiences with his wit, charm, sex appeal, and honesty. And now you are invited to see one of the great actors of our time in a very special motion picture. Paramount Pictures presents Paul Newman.
How about you and me go out there and get ourselves naked and then just see what happens?
Okay.
So when I heard, I did read that, and it was like, oh, he has a son. And I was like, where's the son in the trailer? It has nothing about a son or a family or anything. So I was kind of surprised at, you know, what I actually found when I watched the film. So.
Oh, I totally agree. I didn't watch the trailer until you mentioned, like, this trailer, like, you texted me, like, this trailer is ridiculous, and I watched it and I was like, oh, I have no idea what this movie is about.
Yeah,
but then, yeah, seeing the movie, I'm like, oh, this is all about the father-son thing. That is not in the trailer at all.
No, it was a vehicle. It was a 100% vehicle. And you said we don't see films like this anymore. We also don't make trailers like this anymore that are so blatant that it's like, hey, don't worry about the story, just come see Jennifer Lawrence, you know, whoever it is. You know, don't worry about story. It's fine. You know, you're not really here for the story. You're here for the actor. So that was the trailer. It was interesting.
Yeah, it was really interesting. So as mentioned, Nobody's Fool was written and directed by Oscar winner Robert Benton. It's based on the 1993 novel of the same name written by Richard Russo, who also wrote the novel Empire Falls that Paul Newman and Philip Seymour Hoffman later starred in, a miniseries version of that together in 2005, is one of Paul Newman's final projects. So the film was released on January 13th, 1995. It had an estimated $20 million budget, which means you'd need to make 14 Nobody's Fools to surpass the budget of Star Wars Rise of Skywalker.
Oh, they fly now!
They fly now?
die now.
It was filmed between November 1993 to March 1994 throughout New York State. Looked like some upstate New York locations. Mm-hmm. And it was nominated for 2 Oscars, Paul Newman for Best Actor and Robert Benton for Best Adapted Screenplay. But finally, and why we're here, this is Philip Seymour Hoffman's 12th feature film, where he plays the prickish cop, Officer Raymer, perhaps the more accurate depiction of a police officer we've been craving culturally in the last few months. We're going there. In terms of major titles, this film, like The Yearling, it falls in that sweet star on the rise spot between Son of a Woman and Twister. Rick, initial thoughts on this film?
Yeah, this reminded me of just kind of that late 80s, and even, I guess, throughout the 80s and into the 90s. Like you said, it's just this sweet, sweet film, sweet character. I remember growing up, this was the kind of film, as a person who grew up in the 80s, this is the kind of film I never would have wanted to see, right?
Sure.
And you know, and I was in college when this film came out. Don't remember it, you know. So when you're in film school, those years you're in film school, you're really aware of everything that's happening and all the films coming out. And I do remember the film later on, I guess, as an adult, hearing about it and maybe seeing it advertised. But that in at that time when it was released, I don't remember it coming out. But in watching it again, or watching it for the first time again, I was kind of harkened back to some of these, just like you said, a different type of film. I don't think would get made today, you know. Yeah, it's strange. I mean, there's a lot of things to talk about, I guess, but I'll let you kind of leave
yeah.
That.
I mean, Howard Shore did the score, and it's that weird thing of like that kind of piano-y, like hopeful, but then also sometimes sad score that runs through a lot of the movie. And it's really just like a family drama.
Yeah.
And some of it feels more like a classic American play than any of the quote unquote dramas that have come out in the last couple decades. It's so weird. It feels very much like an era, another era film.
Yeah, the music was very forward. So
yes.
It was like leading you from scene to scene and through scenes. The music was really kind of like way forward than I was kind of used to.
Right.
So I think when you go back and you watch this, you're like, oh, wow. Yeah. And Howard Shore, great composer. But, you know, it was just, it was kind of a little sappy in its music, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. Really forward score works well in, I don't know, Lord of the Rings.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think what was interesting, and if you want to get into this at some point, just the characters, what I found somewhat interesting is that there was this kind of like hopelessness about these characters that led that kind of influenced all their decisions, which on the surface kind of seemed ridiculous that Bruce Willis and Paul Newman's characters were friends.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it was like, why are they friends? Why are they like, how is this happening? Because today I don't think these two people would ever be friends. And I'm like, why does this happen? And maybe I was trying to read into it way more than was there, or maybe not. I don't know. But I was like, you know, I guess these people are just in a hopeless town, kind of in this, you know, in this small town, kind of weird existence. Yeah. And they're not going to become enemies because where else are you going to go? What else are you going to do? I'm going to have to see this person again.
Right.
You find that weird?
I did find that weird. And it's interesting piggybacking on that. Like this, okay, we're not going to become enemies, but we're still going to treat each other so poorly.
Terrible.
And we're still going to do terrible things to each other. And we're going to steal from each other. And we're going to treat each other like shit. And it's just like, but it's fine. We're still going to like play cards and be okay. So that was bizarre.
everyone in the film played cards together, it seemed, but they were all terrible to each other.
Yes.
Then they would all come together and play cards, sometimes half nude, sometimes not.
That was something where the nudity in this film was so all of a sudden.
Yeah.
Like out of nowhere, Melanie Griffith, who plays Toby Roebuck, just flashes him. And flashes. I was like, whoa, what? And then we cut to the bar later in the movie, and Bruce Willis and I forget her name.
His second.
His mistress, secretary. Basically, yeah. Are just topless around yeah. Like, no lead up, just no. Random nudity. Random nudity in this Paul Newman film.
It felt like, at first, you're watching Home Alone, right?
Yes.
It was that era of film.
Yes, and totally.
It's like you're watching Home Alone without, like, snarky kids, but now you have snarky older people.
Yes. Like, those kids just grew up. It's just Buzz. Yeah, it's just, Buzz grew up to be Philip Seymour Hoffman's character.
Yeah.
No, for three reasons. A, I'm not that lucky. Two, we have smoke detectors. And D, we live in the most boring street in the United States of America, where nothing even remotely dangerous will ever happen. Period.
Exactly. But then all of a sudden there's just nudity and then some language. And it's like, what? And it's supposed to be sweet. But then it's like, oh, is Paul Newman really going to run away with Melanie Griffith to Hawaii? And it's weird. It was like this weird mix of genres.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think overall I was disappointed. And I think I was disappointed because like the first 30 minutes, I couldn't really track it. It might have been like 15, 30, 45. Maybe it was the first act. I don't know. But in the beginning, I was bought in. I was like, oh, this is going somewhere. And then, you know, him being stuck on the side of the road and his son showing up. I was like, okay, there's your one coincidence. You know, you get your one, there it is.
Right.
I can ride with this. And then it just started like the dialogue started getting a little bit on the nose and the music was like pushing the tone. And I just started not buying. There were definitely moments where I was like, oh, I realize why Paul Newman is a movie star.
Right.
You know, like it's clear to me that this, and I am like, sadly, have not seen, I don't think any other Paul Newman films. I started watching this one HUD that he won an Oscar for. It's also on Prime. Mm-hmm. I got about 15 minutes into it and I was like, oh, this is interesting. So I'm definitely going to look at more of his stuff just because he's a fixture in American cinema.
Right.
But coming in unfamiliar with him, but still sensing this like star presence carrying a movie, even as an older man. But the story and the dialogue didn't quite land for me. And I didn't really, I guess the like going to Hawaii or not was supposed to be like the climax, you know, our protagonist is sort of making this irreversible decision, but it didn't, I don't know. It didn't stick. What did you feel about that?
Yeah. I didn't buy that was going to happen for a second and then it doesn't. And, you know, I thought there was this kind of flirty, kind of sweet, but kind of scandalous connection between Paul Newman and Melanie Griffith, but I didn't really think that was going to go anywhere. I didn't buy
that. It was like, what? I wasn't always clear what I was, maybe this is the wrong way to put it, but I wasn't always clear what I was supposed to be taking from that.
Yes.
Like, is this supposed to be funny or is this genuine romantic involvement?
Yes.
Or am I supposed to be confused by it? And I think it just ended up being a little too muddled.
Yeah.
That I didn't know how to deal with the ending.
I think that was, I think that's a lot of the film, right? Like, you're not, like, does his son hate him? Does he not hate him?
Right, right.
Like, yeah, there was a lot of that. And it was just kind of like, it was kind of muddled. And I wonder, it came from a book, right? Like, it was adapted from a book. And I wonder, having not read the book, you know, was this the way the book was written? Did something get lost in the translation? Not sure, but it was critically received well, though, at the time.
Yeah, it was. I mean, two Oscar nominations for writing and for Paul Newman. And it was also, I thought a funny or at least interesting segment for this episode would be going into the IMDb user reviews and just looking at people trolling this movie.
Yeah.
all of them were like glowingly positive.
Wow.
People loving this film and mainly loving Paul Newman. Like the Paul Newman fans came out in droves on the 100 user reviews on IMDb.
Yeah.
I don't disagree with them. I wasn't really taken with the film.
Yeah. And what's interesting too is, you know, it was kind of, I don't know how much they changed from the book, but if they didn't change much, it was a classic Paul Newman role, right? Because Paul Newman's thing is he's very quick-witted. He's ultra handsome. So you're always, and he knows it. And he
on his side, even if he's a scoundrel.
Yes. And Paul Newman is, you're always like watching him constantly. Yeah. And I think his roles, you know, his best roles, he plays to that. And he gives these little, you know, he loves the one-liners, and this movie was full of them.
Yeah.
But he does them well, you know? I mean, there's some corny dialogue, but he's able to do it, which I think his son in this film didn't work for me too well. And he had some tough lines. I think you're talking about some dialogue that was on the nose. Yeah. I think his son, you know, was like out of nowhere, it'd be like, so why'd you leave? You know?
I know.
It's like, really? That's where we're gonna go.
Did you ever think about me?
Yeah, did you ever think about me? And it was weird because it was almost like those characters were setting him up to give a few lines of dialogue that were ultimately better than what they said. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Right. So, they were sacrificed on the altar of Paul Newman.
Yes. Somewhat. Yeah. I don't know if that's, again, the way the novel was, but it kind of felt that way. But Jessica Tandy was the exception though. Right. I think.
Yeah.
And it was her last role, right? Her last role before she passed away.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot to include that in the factoid dump, but that was the film was dedicated to her at the end,
yes.
If I recall. Yeah, this was her last performance on screen.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Philip Seymour Hoffman, Officer Raymer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let me just start with a clip.
What's the matter now, Raymer?
Broken taillight. It's the third time. One more time, Sully, and I'm impounding this heap of yours.
Jesus Christ. Raymer, it's Thanksgiving.
Yeah, well, if you fix it the first time, this wouldn't happen. It's $15. You can mail it in or you can come by the station. If it's not paid within 30 days, you'll be held in contempt.
Boy, I hope you get laid sometime soon.
Yeah, someday, smartass. I'm gonna nail you. Hey, when you least expect it.
The best part about that to me is someday I'm going to nail you. The next time we see him, Paul Newman punches him in the face and knocks him out cold in one hit.
One hit.
It really is a classic Philip Seymour Hoffman supporting role, especially for earlier in his career. Recently, we talked about The Yearling on this podcast, which is another 4, 5, 6 scene role where I think Phil makes an even larger impact in that film and really has more to do with the story. This one is kind of like you said, it's a character who functions to pull out the, is it the scoundrel side or the like, he's like the town nuisance, but everyone also loves it.
Yeah, exactly.
That poor Officer Raymer.
Yeah. He just serves as like the law, as you know, conforming to society, and Paul Newman, the way he feels about it is, I'm just going to punch you in the face. That's my thoughts on.
Walks
conforming.
Up to him, you prick! Boom.
But he does. He shoots at him, right? So the reason he punches him is he shoots at him, and then apparently we find the bullet hit a woman on the toilet or something. Like,
wait, it hit her? Wait, I thought she just like. Oh gosh. I thought it just like she was hurt it and got scared.
Maybe. Okay. Yeah. It was just like
hit her. He'd be like,
he'd be in jail. Yeah.
Yeah. But you know what I found interesting, like about the role, and just touching on kind of what is happening culturally right now in conversations about the police brutality, just sort of the weirdness about the, police officers in our country and the power that they wield is my personal experience with police officers has been much closer to this Philip Seymour Hoffman character.
Oh, geez.
Where they're just like mean.
Yeah.
And they're just like mean and authoritative. And so many police officer roles that we see are comedic, are bumbling idiot, or like genius saving the day, you know, like detectives. This was right. just like, oh, I know this cop. Like this yeah. cop has pulled me over and shamed me for making a small mistake and exercised his authority and power over me. And I think the thing that I love about Phil's portrayal is it's like it's simultaneously intimidating and pathetic.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know? He's like scary and like, you know, he was a thick, stocky guy and mm-hmm. a deep voice. But at the same time, you're like, oh, man, you're just yeah. so. And then it just like that proves itself when he gets punched, knocked out by an old man in one yeah. shot.
Well, he starts. What was great is that, you know, they've had run-ins, right? Because
yes.
he starts at a 10. Like he comes yes. out of the car like he wants to already kill Paul Newman. So this has happened, you know, many times yeah. before.
Yeah, I love when a performance brings in the history. You yeah. know, it's like no exposition, nothing. We're just gonna let the actor bring all of the relational history and we know.
Yeah. He just comes at him. And you know, and then at the end, he's totally humiliated, right? And
yes.
when he's interviewed later. Everyone hates him, apparently.
Tell me, what do you usually do when somebody throws a punch at you?
Doc?
Next time, do that. Oh, is it true that you discharged your weapon, officer?
Your Honor, it was a warning shot.
Mm-hmm. You know who you warned? A little old lady sitting on her commode 2 blocks away. Ollie, you know my feelings about arming morons. You arm one, you've got to arm them all. Otherwise, it wouldn't be good sport.
Your Honor, Officer Raymer is currently under suspension.
Anesthesia is what he should be under.
Your Honor, I'd just like to say, and what's this country coming to?
Raymer, shut the fuck up.
I mean, again, just such relevant dialogue for our times.
It reminded me of the Ghostbusters scene where there's like the city, that there's like the mayor and then like the assistant mayor, and he's just like going off, and then like, you know, the Ghostbusters are making fun of him in front of yeah. everyone, and it's just yeah, it's very strange. And what's funny, he's sitting there, like what's funny is he's sitting there and he can't even see out of one eye, right? Like he's
black and blue.
He's like bloody, he's still like bleeding or something, and he looks terrible. And then he gets up and just leaves, right? In a huff. Like he's just totally pathetic.
And I love the other thing I love. It's one of those, like, if you've watched a lot of the PSH canon, you pick up on these weird things. After the judge asks, you know, what, when someone throws a punch, what do you do? It's this elongated pause. It's just like, it's got to be 5 full seconds and then duck. Like, Phil was never afraid to take an absurd pause.
Yeah.
And it's such a dangerous thing to do as an actor, because I think a lot of times actors think, it's like, that's where the phrase pause for effect comes from. You know, it's right. like, or a dramatic pause. It's like, oh, I'm going to put a pause in. You know, it's almost something that has turned campy and unmotivated and really fake in a lot of acting. Hmm. But every time Phil puts in a pause, it's almost like it's in an unnecessary place,
right?
But it makes it so much more interesting.
Well, I yeah, to me it was like, I don't want to answer you and I'm not yeah. going to. But then he does, because a judge just asked him a question, right?
Yeah, it's almost like he's hoping the judge will like go on, like it was a hypothetical or right. change subjects. And but it's interesting to think about that from an acting situation. I mean, very well in the script, it could have said a long pause, you know, part of it. We never know how these things are totally crafted.
Sure.
How the sausage gets made. But I love that there, you know, some measure, some level of thought or instinct had to go into creating that pregnant pause.
Yeah.
And then just like, what is this country coming to? What's the sub? Give me the subtext there from the writer's perspective. What's going on there?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's interesting because, like, you know, you could look at what was happening actually at that time. Was he making any kind of social commentary at the time, or is it just a reflection of the cop, the authority figure, who's kind of just always, you know, this is the way we do things, the way we always done things. And my kind of answer to everything is, what's the country coming to? Back in my day, we used to, you know, shoot people first and ask questions later. And
right. Yeah, it's that authoritarian state thing of like, why are the cops even being questioned?
Yeah.
You know, it's that sense of police entitlement that, whoo, we got to get rid of. It's not good.
Yeah, I think he was just very, you know, he was very interested, kind of like in a Barney Fife kind of way, of every law really being followed to the T. And he got really hot very quickly if it wasn't. Yeah. And then obviously had some kind of issue with Scully, because Scully just didn't care. He just didn't give a crap about this guy at all.
No, and, he really didn't. It's interesting too. This Officer Raymer character, you know, that first scene comes in at a 10. We sort of sense via Paul Newman the patheticness of this, even though he is an intimidating force. And then, like, when he's pulling him over because he's riding on the sidewalk, it's so clear that there's fear of, like, I like pulling out his gun. He's terrified. He shoots it on accident. He's just like mortified at actually using his police tools.
Yeah.
Like all training goes out the window. It's just,
it was funny too. I laughed because there was even like an extra shot of him turning around in the street, and like, he doesn't do it. Like, he's going the opposite way that Scully's going. And then he has to kind of like turn his car around. It's not totally smooth. You know what I mean?
Right.
You almost imagine. I thought he was going to like stop and back up again and then come forward. Yeah, he's totally not like comfortable doing his job. But man, he really feels passionate about it though.
Yes. And in these, you know, I think it's these small roles that can kind of capture, like when a small role can capture that sort of complexity. And I don't mean like emotional complexity or like paradox or deep contradiction that's really interesting, but just like a few different facets of a police officer with a chip on his shoulder in a small town who is really passionate but also really insecure and probably untrained and has it out for the main guy. But it's just kind of like a child, you know, he's like a man child with his deep voice and his presence. But then, man, what's this country coming to? You know, such little screen time, but doing all those things. I love it.
Yeah, absolutely.
From a writing perspective, because you're a screenwriter, you're a film professor, you teach screenwriting. Smaller roles. Oftentimes you think, especially in the theater, like less characters, less forces out there, less things I have to develop, like really focus on the protagonist and developing them and the conflict and their character, blah, 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 blah. But in robust storytelling, it's often these smaller characters that are revealing things about the protagonist. They're almost necessary, but they're also hard to make interesting. So I just want to hear you kind of riff about minor roles, because Phil has a lot of those credits, and I'd love to hear from a writing perspective what you think about that.
Yeah, so when you sit down to write, you know, you have a blank page, and when you're sitting down and you have a scene in front of you, you know, the goal is one of two things, which actually is one thing. And what I mean by that is, in that scene, you want to either explain more about your main character or whatever character is kind of prominent in that scene. You want to develop that character, or you want to move the plot forward, right? So whatever is going to go into that scene needs to do one of those two things, or really you're going to probably end up cutting it out at some point. Mm. So a character is part of that. It's, you know, a minor character is part of that, in that it's he or she is going to be used to develop the primary character. And what we said with Paul Newman's character is what this policeman does. It does help develop his like disregard for authority and the law. And he's his own man. And, you know, he doesn't have time for this nonsense. And so that's on one level, that's what it does. On the second level, in moving the plot forward, the actual story of this happens, then this happens, and this happens. You know, spoiler, Paul Newman has to go to jail, right? Yeah. So this policeman is a tool in the plot of the story to get him to this kind of, you know, because it's really not the climax, but getting him in jail and kind of getting him, you know, to a low, so to speak. Right,
Dark Night of the Soul, kind of, not really.
Kind of, but yeah, I think they missed something there with that. You know, we didn't even see him in the police station. Right. We didn't see him isolated. He just kind of goes in and comes out. Yeah.
And they made it such a big deal that he was going to jail, but it was also like no one was taking him to jail. He just like walked over there, and it felt like it was supposed to be meaningful, but because he wasn't like arrested or I don't know. So yeah, something about that missed, but continue.
Something about it missed. But again, it was that weird part of that town where it was just kind of like everything happened that way.
Right.
You know, we're not going to really arrest you. You're just going to kind of have to come up and turn yourself in. Right. But
our one cop is on suspension right now. So sorry. He can't arrest you.
That's it. Yeah. That's probably it. He probably, there's no way to bring him in. Right. So he's going to have to turn himself in. But yeah, so, you know, with minor characters, I mean, hopefully what we try to do is make them meaningful and give the actor something to work with, you know, and make it enjoyable for every actor who's going to either be a major character or a minor character. And I think, again, if you're approaching storytelling from a scene by scene or chapter by chapter basis, you're trying to decide what goes in, what stays in, what goes out. You know, how can you, it's a good exercise. It's a good reminder of how can you make these minor characters important too and relevant and jump off the screen a little bit. You know, we hear about scene stealers and that sort of thing.
Phil is notorious for being referred to as a scene stealer.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure you can cut this out or not, but I'm sure you're going to talk about Moneyball at some point. And he does that, you know, personally knowing who Art Howe was and as a player and as a manager, kind of seeing him appear on screen, you know, that's a scene stealing kind of role for me, you know, to see him bring Art Howe to life in Moneyball. But yeah, I think his character did that. I don't think, if someone said, well, that was a pointless character for this film. No, it absolutely wasn't. We learned something about the protagonist through him. And he was part of the plot. He was part of the legal system that got our main character eventually into jail. So I think it worked.
Yeah. Yeah. I would agree. And I mean, just reiterating what I said before, being able to take that, like, I could just see myself reading this character on the page and feeling a one-dimensionality to it. But then, like, the work of the actor, whether you have one line or 1,500 lines, the work of the actor is finding all of the opportunity in each line. And that's one of the things that has always attracted me to Philip Seymour Hoffman. It's why I'm doing this friggin' podcast, is because he never let a line go. You know, every line was precious. Every line was an opportunity to show a different facet to the character or lean into a dominant facet of the character. And there's plenty of films that he's been in that aren't necessarily great films, but he elevates the material, which most great actors oftentimes find themselves being attached to incredible material, and it just like they blossom because of it. It brings them to life.
Right.
It's the rare actor who can take something that's a little less interesting or a little mediocre or subpar and just make choices that at least make it interesting, you know, because that's at some level when you're on screen for 7 minutes, really all you can do is I'm here to function to move the story forward. So let's make sure I'm doing that. And am I interesting to watch? You know, my friend and director, Mary Gunlock, that's like her criteria for everything. Is it interesting to watch? And Phil was always interesting to watch. something Ethan Hawke keeps coming up on this podcast, and it's because, you know, they did Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, which incidentally is going to be our next episode. Ethan Hawke and Philip Seymour Hoffman, they also worked at the Labyrinth Theater Company together. They were friends and collaborators. I was doing some digging. I found an article where Ethan Hawke mentions Paul Newman and Philip Seymour Hoffman, which I thought was like, how did this quote, you know, Google does some amazing things once you start typing in right. different combinations. It says, Hawke says Hoffman and Daniel Day-Lewis are third-person actors, disappearing beyond semblance of self. Paul Newman, he says, was a first-person actor, always good, but always Paul Newman. For 20 years, he says, I was a first-person actor. Then slowly, I've been exploring having a whole other interest in different kinds of characters. It's made acting so much more interesting. And it made me think about... It kind of put words to this thing that I have spoken about before. You know, there's so many great actors who they're riveting to watch. They're beautiful. And I don't necessarily mean in an attractive sense, but they are like beautiful on camera. They're beautiful on screen, their face, their eyes, right. they are just meant for the cinema. And yes. they may turn in very similar performances over and over and over. But they're always compelling. And I mean, again, I haven't seen a lot of Paul Newman's films, only this one. But even from watching that, the beginning of HUD, the sense of like, okay, Paul Newman was like a movie star type of actor, where sure. it's, I have a presence, I have a twinkle in my eye, I have dastardly good looks, and I am always going to be good. That kind of acting right. has never... Like, as an actor, it's never interested me. And I think it's funny how, like, the way that we see ourselves, the way that we are physically, we kind of like, okay, what's the story I'm going to tell myself to validate my own my own desires, you know? So it's like, I'm 6'5", right. you know, in my life, anywhere from 260 to 300 pounds over the past 10 years, sure. oscillating between there. I am not Paul Newman. You know, I'm going to be scary characters. I'm going to be like pathetic characters. I'm going to be like the funny sidekick characters, and like embracing the challenge and the excitement of playing all different types of roles, right. rather than maybe the movie star or the Paul Newman type or the, I mean, there's tons of, I hate throwing actors under the bus, but I don't even sure. mean it as like a bad thing. You know, it's like we need, right. we need Paul Newmans. We need mm-hmm. those types of actors, but we also need Philip Seymour Hoffmans who are kind of chameleoning. That's not a word. Chameleoning yeah. their way through different films.
Being an educator and, you know, working around theater students and working with young actors and different actors. I think that's a good point. You know, it's, you know, your physicality and how you see yourself really is going to kind of influence your approach and, yeah. and is probably something you should really think about and process feeling, you know, so you can be productive and right. feel good moving forward as an actor.
Yeah. I think that's where I was trying to land, but I didn't quite make it, but it was thinking about my high school self who was like, you know, I want to be a leading man in musicals. And like, that's what I love. And that's what I'm interested in. And then getting cast in roles early in college and even doing JB in high school where it was like, more towards, I guess, how society could accept me in a role. And this is where like acting is very sad. And it's like, no wonder so many of us are just so insecure right, and have like yeah. Body image issues and all that kind of stuff. But like getting a taste of like, oh, wait, I can do these other things and be another person. You know, this idea of the third person actor. I think it was this combination of like getting cast in some of those roles. And then also exactly what you said, like, okay, I'm just going to tell myself this story now of this is who I am. This is the kind of actor that I'm going to be. And rather than like bemoan that, like, oh, I don't get to be the ingenue or the leading man. It's like, embrace the things that are unique about you. Embrace the fact that there's probably a role out there that no one could play as good as you as an actor. And just like thinking about it that way. And I don't even know that like my own, you know, what is my style? You know, my style is copy Philip Seymour Hoffman to the best of my ability, which I actually think is part of the process, you know, stealing from your idols and kind of finding your own way. I think the unique thing about Phil was that he seemed to have a strong sense of style and individuality from a very young age. I have one more clip that I want to play, and I believe it was on the Capote Award circuit where someone asked him about, you know, what's your advice to young actors? And this is what Hoffman said.
This is really, when you're first starting out, is you have to act wherever you can. You can't be picky. You really have to act wherever you can and wherever you get a chance to act. And that might even be just in an audition room. This is something a teacher told me years ago, and he's right. Even if you're auditioning for something that you know you're never going to get, or you might have read it and you might not even have liked it, but you know that you have to go, that if you get a chance to act in a room that somebody else has paid rent for, then you're given a free chance to practice your craft. And in that moment, you should act as well as you can, because if you leave the room or the theater or wherever you are and you've acted as well as you can, there's no way that the people who've watched you will forget it. And that was something that somebody told me a long time ago, and I do think that's the only advice, because it's always about that. It's always about the work at the end of the day. Everybody knows that. If I show up to work one day and the work I'm doing isn't any good, I'm just a guy who's not acting well. I mean, I'm a guy who's not acting well, you know, and you're just always back to that moment. You're always back to that moment where you have to act as well as you can. And I would say to anybody starting out, it's like, if you're given a chance to act, take those words and bring them alive. And if you do that, something will transpire ultimately.
One thing that kind of came to mind during that is, kind of what you're talking about how you see yourself, how other people see you, you know, an issue there is that you start to be typecast, right?
Yes.
And you're always going to be that guy. So I think one thing too that's interesting, whenever you get a chance to act, is what he's saying, is maybe you're going to read for something that's not your normal typecast role. And maybe someone will see something and be like, wait a minute, I didn't see this character this way, but no, I totally want to go that way. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it could even offer an opportunity for you, you know, if someone feels like they're an actor who's getting typecast, the more you're auditioning, the more you're acting, the more you're in anything you can be in, the more you're also allowing yourself an opportunity to break free of your typecast, so to speak.
Yeah, I think that's such a good point. And just thinking about how the industry as a whole, whether it's film or theater, acting, it seems like there's an opening up occurring, whether it's across race, gender, body type. You know, more and more people are there. The demand for more diverse stories and storytellers.
Right.
And I don't even mean in race, gender, sexuality, but also in, you know, we're tired of seeing Brad Pitt as the, you know, when are we going to see more normal looking people play these roles? You know, I don't know that
sure.
We're there. We're not there by any means, but I think those conversations are happening in casting rooms. And I think producers are interested in how do we make this more interesting, make it connect to a wider audience or different audience? How do we cast against type and see what could happen from it? So yeah, I think the advice of, gosh, always in whatever moment you're in, be doing the work, because someone could see something in you that you never knew existed in yourself. I mean, I know that's happened
for
me from, you talk about being a professor. I'm sure you have I know you have given this to your students before. You know, when a teacher imparts that sense of, I believe in you, I see this in you, and it's something unexpected and surprising, it's incredibly impactful. So the more opportunities we give ourselves to be shaped by a new opinion as an actor, because you are just kind of putting yourself out there for judgment all the time, the better, I think.
That's right. No, yeah, absolutely.
Rick, what do you have a favorite Philip Seymour Hoffman film, performance? What's sort of your own personal history and interest in the man?
You know, I think just some of the major roles that everyone looks at, like The Master and other films, where, you know, I mean, he's doing it at another level. Capote, he's doing it at another level, and you know, and people really respond to that, and it's obvious why. And as I said, I thought, you know, these small roles like Art Howe in Moneyball, which was kind of a surprising film to me when I saw it. I didn't expect that much from that film, but there are some good roles and some good performances in it. I thought he didn't say much, but stood out well. And I've used scenes from Moneyball as examples in classes on, you know, how to not write dialogue on the nose, right? So I'll show Anakin Skywalker speaking.
If you're not with me, then you're my enemy.
And say, this is how you write on the nose, with him and Natalie Portman kind of going back and forth. And
Anakin, breaking my heart. You're going down a path I can't follow.
You're breaking my heart, and I can't go. I can't, you know, go where you're going or whatever, right? So I'll play these lines and say, okay, not good, you know, and then I'll show other scenes. And I've shown the clip where Brad Pitt is talking to Philip Seymour Hoffman in the hallway, and Philip Seymour Hoffman has his arms crossed. He's barely saying anything, but you're kind of getting this whole relationship and everything that's happening here just from that simple scene. And I'm just trying to use it to say, you know, you don't have to write on the nose and you know, you shouldn't and all of these things. So, yeah. So, you know, my wife knows that I was doing this podcast and she watched this film with me, and she was like, you know, I've seen him in a lot of things, you know, like as small roles and a lot of things. And it's like, I haven't liked him in any of them. And she didn't. And I pressed her further. And it's not that she didn't like him as an actor. Yeah. She had just seen him in lots of character in a lot of films where she didn't like his character.
Wow.
And what I've noticed about my wife and I go to her for this, because she gets a very kind of like emotional reaction, you know, and you know, empath type of reaction to characters, right? So she wants, you know, she doesn't like, you know, she has a hard time with Christopher Nolan films because they're so dark. And it's just, you know, and but I think like that's the point, right? I think he's trying to be visually and aesthetically dark. So when she says these things, I don't judge her. I listen to what she's saying, because, you know, oftentimes she's kind of giving credence and she's, you know, saying, yeah, this is the director has wanted to do this and he did it. And I think when she's saying she didn't like Philip Seymour Hoffman's character or characters and things, I think it's a testament that she remembered him being in these films. And she had an emotional reaction to it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's so interesting. Yeah, like seeing that face connects to a negative emotion from the past. And you're just like, ugh.
Right, of a character that he was being asked to be a creep or mean or whatever it was, right? So he was able to deliver and kind of what we've been talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. So,
yes, she needs to watch some of his, she needs to watch Magnolia, or you know, some of these films, or Boogie Nights, where he's just tragic and lonely, and the empath will certainly be activated. And that's what I love about him. You know, this range of like a hard character who instills fear, all the way to a really broken character in need of help. You feel it on both ends, and I think it's a beautiful thing.
I'm always home. I'm on cool.
Did you have any like Robert Benton? Because Kramer versus Kramer is a phenomenal film.
Yeah.
I didn't know if you had any Robert Benton factoids, tidbits, anything interesting.
What's interesting about Robert Benton is not only the things he directed, because he directed a handful of films, probably 10 or 12 or so, but he also wrote these films as well. So he was the writer on Bonnie and Clyde that Arthur Penn directed in 1967.
Wow.
So that was very interesting. I didn't know that. Right. And he co-wrote the Superman, the Christopher Reeve Superman that we all love in 1978 as well.
Wow.
And then he was also the writer of Kramer versus Kramer. So it's kind of interesting to see him work in this. He had some diversity, and did some different things and directed a handful of stuff as well, and kind of had a few bright moments of success, right? And then that was kind of it. The other thing, when I was watching the credits, I saw those Scott Rudin films.
Yes.
So Scott Rudin's. I
pointed that out to my wife because we watched it together too. And I was like, you know, Scott Rudin has produced more film and theater than any man on earth, right? Like, that guy is crazy.
Yeah. And what's crazy is he must have been pretty young for this because he's only 62 now. So, we're talking, he was in his 30s, like when he produced this film. He's the only guy that's, won all four big awards for entertainment, right? Emmy, Tony, Oscar, and Grammy, I guess.
EGOT. I think we've got some more EGOTs, but he's certainly one of them.
But also, too, allegedly, I don't know this for a fact, but allegedly not a nice person to work for.
A real Harvey Weinstein, if you ask me.
I'm saying allegedly, right? I thought it was interesting when I saw his name. I'm like, wait a minute. I kind of thought, I kind of figured what I was getting into, early 90s, older Paul Newman film. But we're talking about the guy who produced this, also produced The Social Network and No Country for Old Men. And so it's like he's still in the game producing much different type of work. Yeah. So, and I did not know until he appeared on screen. I didn't know Bruce Willis was in this film.
I knew because I looked at the credits, but I completely forgot. And you would never expect it. And then all of a sudden there he is. I read, this is one of those things that's like trivia that could totally be fake, but I read that his his action star rate was like $15 million or something. There's no way it was that much back then, right?
Right.
There's no way it was that much. I'm sure it was a lot though, but apparently he took a massively reduced rate because he wanted to work with Paul Newman on this film.
I did see that. Yeah, I saw that too. He took it was $1,500 a week.
Yeah, it was a scale or something.
Yeah. And I mean, we're talking about this is height of Bruce Willis right now.
Die Hard, Pulp Fiction. I mean,
Yeah, he still had some hair or maybe not. I don't know. Wigs
right,
are good.
Right.
I thought he was good. He was Bruce Willis. I thought he was entertaining.
Yes.
And it was nice to see him in it. I think he did add something to it. He was a real jerk, and that was funny.
Yes. So. Yeah. They had good chemistry. Paul Newman and Bruce Willis had a really good chemistry.
Yeah.
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
That is sponsored by One County Film, an independent film company telling stories with authentic characters and unique settings. You can rent our debut feature film, Palace, on Amazon right now. That's That is produced by me, Timothy Mark Davis, and edited by Ryan Arnst. Our show music was composed and edited by Jessica Ray Huber, and our graphic was designed by Drew Hannigan. You can connect with One County Film on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at One County Film. You can connect with me on Twitter at Timothy Mark DAV, Timothy Mark DAV, and Instagram at Timothy Mark Davis. Rick, where can the people connect with you if you want them to?
Yeah, you can find me at RL Negron, NEGRON is the spelling of that, on Instagram. And I really enjoyed being here today. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you all for listening to That's That. Please remember to rate, review, and subscribe. It will help get the podcast out there to more PSH lovers and film lovers, and we'll see you next time with an in-depth look into Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, the 1997 film starring Philip Seymour Hoffman, Ethan Hawke, and Marissa Tomei, and Albert Finney. It's the final film of legendary director Sidney Lumet? How do you say that? Sidney Lumet of 12 Angry Men and Dog Day Afternoon fame. Here is the log line from IMDb. When two brothers organize the robbery of their parents' jewelry store, sounds like a Davis Brothers setting, jewelry store, the job goes horribly wrong, triggering a series of events that sends them, their father, and one brother's wife hurtling towards a shattering climax. Before the Devil Knows You're Dead is currently streaming on HBO. You can probably rent it for a couple bucks as well if you don't have HBO. And my guest will be filmmaker, actor, and friend Edson Gein. So please watch and then join us for a deep dive. Rick, before we leave, I need the guest to quote Adam Sandler from Punch Drunk Love in a line he says to Dean Trumbull, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman. And the line is, "That's that, Mattress Man."
That's that, Mattress Man.
That's that, everybody.
Now, wait a second. We forgot the most intriguing character in this film, and that's Paul Newman's other child grandson named Whacker. I kid you not, this kid's name is Whacker because of his tendency to go around and whack people and just for being an all-around jerk. Now, Whacker only lasts about halfway through this film because he literally gets whacked in the whacker, and then he disappears, which apparently doesn't make a bit of difference to his father or grandfather because, well, he's Whacker.